So, Mike, thank you for joining us today. This is our next episode of Suits and Shoes. And just following your journey has been inspiring. From 15 years old when you did your first car wash and started or continued your working journey through your political career. I mean, I was just reading the list of every board, committee, association. Like, I was just like, wow. And then on top of that, you got family. You're running for governor. And you even had time to send me a Christmas card. By the way, thank you for that. So my first question to you, what does it take to be Mike Kehoe, Lieutenant Governor, former businessman, family man, running for governor, making such a big impact here in Missouri and around the country?
Well, Pavel, first of all, thank you for having me on. You're an inspiration to me. Your story and what you've done to create jobs here in Springfield, the products you build that are amazing. Watching a little piece of your journey for me is kind of one of those things that keep me going. And so it's a balance, as you know. My wife and I have been married 34 years.
Oh, wow.
We have four children that sometimes drive us crazy, but for the most part, we're very proud of. They're all out on their own, which is a great feeling. You'll see someday that we love the miracle of the Lord's gift at birth, but the miracle when they move out of the house is pretty special.
That's amazing.
And so, you know, I'm not a good guy that sit around very much. I'm not a sit on the beach, rub your toes in the sand type person. I just like to be doing something. I'm one of those people that enjoys having four or five balls in the air. Wow. You and I are very the same,
yeah,
very much the same, because I see that in you. And so it's a balance, but you can't forget, you know, the kind of the Northern Star.
Yeah.
I'm here because of God's good graces. I had a strong mother who was incredibly influential in my life. And now I have a strong wife who's incredibly influential in my life and my, you know, four kids. So I think a strong foundation in faith and family is kind of what helps keep you balanced.
That's amazing that you say that. So building off of that, it sounds like your childhood had a big role in your success today, both politically and professionally. Could you kind of expand on that, of the role that it played, and maybe some examples of how that helped you later on in life?
Sure. So I grew up in North City, St. Louis, so on the eastern side of Missouri. I was very much an inner city person. You know, our houses were so close together, you could literally touch them. That's how close they were. A very urban area, very hardworking blue class area. My mom and dad had six kids. I was the youngest of six.
That's
and for reasons we never really found out, when I was a year old, my dad left. And so my mom had six kids to fend for. And she worked multiple jobs. We say three, but, you know, there were times when she had seasonal jobs delivering phone books, which you don't even know what a phone book is. My kids don't either. But just different things that she did to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, if you would have measured us in material goods, I guess you would have said we were poor. But if you married us in faith and love, we had all we wanted.
That's amazing.
And so she really instilled in her children a very good work ethic. And she also instilled in us, you know, how to be humble, number one, and that it's okay to dream,
yeah,
to want to do better.
Yeah.
And so my mom was a big fan of making sure that we worked as hard as we could, and that really, if you love the Lord and you're willing to work hard, there's nothing you can't do.
Yeah.
And so you can get to whatever level of success that it is. It's different levels. Different people have different definitions for what that means. But she was very encouraging that, you know, we can do what we want to do. We just have to work hard.
Yeah.
So, as you mentioned, I started washing cars when I was 15 years old. That was a big break. And the gentleman that owned that was a Ford dealership in South County. A guy named Dave Sinclair really kind of took me under his wing. He had seven kids already, so he
wow.
didn't have a lot of room in the stable,
yeah,
if you know what I mean. But he was kind enough to take me under his wing. I got along with all of his kids very well, and he essentially became my mentor and really the reason I'm here in life. If I had to peg it on one person, I'd say my mom was the foundation, and Mr. Sinclair was the guy who kind of built on that foundation and taught me a lot about business and life and how to treat people,
yeah,
and what you know, a customer experience is all about, and again, what a good hard work ethic is all about.
That's extraordinary. I could definitely relate to that. As you know, I'm one of 11 in my family.
Yes.
And my dad was an over-the-road truck driver throughout most of his career. And so it was my mom raising us, putting food on the table. And I think that played a key in my life as well for laying the foundation. I really like how you highlighted that. The inspiration for my podcast is those key mentors in my life that really helped me get where I am today. Sure. And you're one of those individuals. I wanted to thank you for helping
me in
my journey. And like I always say, this is just the beginning for me. I wanted to kind of expand more on what did those individuals in your life do for you to help you excel through your professional career early on, especially?
Well, you know, I think that the people who are influencers of me taught me a couple of things. One, how, you know, to really know what work is and to work hard.
Yeah.
I definitely know what hard times are. And I definitely know what hard work is.
Yeah.
And hard work can help you get out of hard times. Mr. Sinclair's favorite saying was, don't be a clock watcher.
Mm.
You know, make sure that you put in the time it takes to finish the job. It doesn't mean if you're supposed to get off at 5 or 6 in the afternoon, if the job's
right.
not finished, keep working. That was a big piece of it. Mr. Sinclair, as well as other people, including my mother and some other mentors that I had along the way, really also taught me the importance of relationships. You know, how to meet somebody, understand who they are, and then build a relationship with that person. I can't tell you how many people that I met, maybe selling a car or doing some trivial task, maybe washing a car,
yeah.
that years later, when I needed help in a certain industry or I needed an attorney to help me organize a corporation,
yeah.
I went back to Mr. Dolan, who I washed his cars all
wow.
the time, who was one of the best corporate attorneys in St. Louis.
Wow.
And guess who helped me? The guy whose car I used to wash. And that was an insignificant job, but I took it very seriously, and he was always super nice to me, and I thought, when I need this help, I'm going to go to this guy, and he was there. So trying to make sure you build relationships with people and understand that there's a plan, and those people might come back into your life,
yeah.
and being able to utilize that.
That's extraordinary. It reminds me of Doug Pitt and the role he played in my life. I'll never forget the day he first came with his van for us to do some work on his van.
Yeah.
And from then on, he's become one of my biggest mentors. And so that's amazing. That's a good takeaway to always, you know, value those first clients. And so I followed your journey really closely through your success. What would you attribute your success through your kind of peak in businesses between the four dealerships, the van conversions? What would you attribute your success to?
Well, I think much of my success is always surrounding me with really good people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that smart, so I need smarter people around me. But seriously, getting people around you and giving them an opportunity
yeah.
to become leaders, to make themselves better. They appreciate who they are much more. They value what they're doing for you. Being able to have people around you who are really good at what they want to do and are really dedicated. I'm big on loyal people.
Yeah.
And it's very important. And so surrounding yourself with really high quality people, I think is a key. And then the partnerships you form, you know, the partnerships, whether it's a corporate attorney, as we mentioned earlier, with your financial institution, I think those partners are really good. Having a relationship with people who understand your business, I think that's incredibly important. Vendors,
yeah.
As you know, my first business is your business, manufacturing custom vans and yeah. trucks, maybe never to the coolness that you do, by the way.
Well, I appreciate
eventually
that.
Eventually into the emergency vehicle space. But the relationship with your vendors is really important.
Yeah.
Trying to make sure you always keep an open mind on what it is to take to grow your business and who you're going to need to get there is something that I've always thought was a key to success.
Yeah, people always kind of, not always, but in a large part, oh, it must be your dad's money. Oh, it must be your mom's money. It's like, no, it's the people that we surround ourselves with.
Well, listen, I got that question all the time. Is
how
much money did your dad give you to start this conversion van business? And where'd you get the money to do this? And where I said, you know, the old-fashioned way, I worked hard and had relationships with banks and people that were willing to invest in me. And you know that
yeah,
story
yeah.
as well.
I like that. Can I take that answer?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to use that the next time someone asks me. So now we continue. You had a very successful journey in business. And at what point did you decide, hey, I want to go into politics?
You know, I really never wanted to go into politics. It's very strange. As I mentioned, we had a manufacturing business in Lynn, Missouri. Our employees end up purchasing that from me, and I'm very proud of the business that they've built and the success they've had. And my wife ultimately bought the Ford and Lincoln dealership in Jefferson City, Missouri. In the state capitol, you could literally, from our lot, you could see the top of the building. I mean, it was about 2 miles. Yeah. It still is about two and a half miles away. Never had much interest in going down there or figuring out what's going on. But you and I both know what happens in business because you've experienced it. All of a sudden, you hit this government roadblock, and you're like, hey, wait a minute. Why am I hitting this roadblock? I'm trying to, you know, provide jobs for people and just trying to do my thing. And you get a little bit aggravated with government. Yeah. And so you try to find people that will help you out, and then you start to understand the process a little bit. And really what probably got me in, to answer your question, we had a governor back in 2005 through 9 named Matt Blunt. Matt and I were friends, and I was just really watching governance and political campaigns from afar. Yeah. And I've got a lot more involved with Matt. His father, Roy, was our U.S. senator and was good friends with that family. And they were really the inspiration to see that you can get into politics, as in my case, as a business person, and you can be a statesman. You don't have to be a like a career politician or something. You can just get in because you want to make a difference. Yeah. And I think that's what the Blunt family did, and certainly that kind of inspired me into getting into politics.
That's awesome. I really love your approach to it. It's almost like a business approach in politics, and I see such success behind it. I want to share a story that Jack insisted I share, and if you want, we can cut it out after the interview, but just an example of one of my first interactions with you in office, and that was we were getting ready to groundbreak on our new factory, and we had a little bit of a misunderstanding with the Department of Conservation Agency, and they had kind of put a stop to our construction with some misunderstanding. I can't remember, it was blind fish or bats, some kind of extinct species. And it was so interesting because our lot was on a hill. The city says it makes no sense, and we're like making phone calls and emails, and it's just not really making any progress. And after all our research, we just didn't know what to do next. And I remember it was the night before we were supposed to close on the loan in order to groundbreak and get done in a timely fashion to fulfill our backlog. And it must have been probably 11:30 at night. And I sent you an email. I'm like, hey, Mike, can you point me in the right direction of what I need to do to overcome this barrier? And you responded past midnight. If I remember correctly, it was 12:31 in the middle of the night.
You have a great memory. I'm trying to remember what I had for breakfast.
And you responded, hey, I will look into this. And in my mind, I'm like, another political answer. Nothing's going to happen. I go to bed. 9 o'clock in the morning, the director of conservation agency calls me on my cell phone. And he says, Pavel, I hear you're coming across some roadblocks. What can I do for you? And I said, well, I think there's this misunderstanding or something's going on. Can you point us in the right direction? He's like, I am so sorry about that. We got the wrong lot. He looked into it. He's like, what can I do to help you close on your loan at noon that day? I'm like, well, can you start by sending a letter with your letterhead and your signature saying that, hey, this is just a miscommunication. Everything's approved. Everything is good. At about noon-ish, Luke, my loan officer, emails me. He's like, Pavel, I don't know how you did that, but we're good to close. And so I wanted to tell you thank you for that. And my question is, you're continuing to grow your political career. How do you envision continuing to bring that change? Because our business is really, I think it's small. Some people say it's one of the biggest in the area. But how do you envision you continuing to do that for other businesses?
Your business is important because you employ a lot of people and provide opportunities for families. So I
would
say
that you
should always think that. And on the conservation issue, you know, sometimes you get into those issues and you find a quick answer and thank goodness it worked out well for you. But my approach to governance is through small business. And the people in different state departments used to kind of laugh and giggle with me because I'd have a meeting and they know I always started the meeting with this statement. We're going to make decisions at business speed, not bureaucratic speed.
I like
that.
Because
those are two different speeds.
Yeah.
And, you know, the state of Missouri has a lot of really good men and ladies who work for them. They're good intentioned people. You would like them. They're good family people. They're good Christian people. They're just well-meaning people. But They've never had the experience that you and I have had. Right. They've never had a deadline to go close a loan. They've never had to go make payroll. They've never had to deal with these problems that you have running a small business. And that doesn't make them bad people. It just means that they just haven't had that experience. And so when I'm dealing with our various departments, especially when it comes to a business, especially when it comes to a small business, I'm always trying to make them and ask them to look through the lens of the person they're trying to help. Yeah. And if you can do that, and we can get government more to understand what it is for people to be providing jobs, providing risk, and, you know, making a difference in our state and our state's economy, we'll govern a lot better.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. You're currently Lieutenant Governor of Missouri, second term. First term selected by Governor Parsons himself, second term elected by the people. And so I think that speaks volume within itself. I wanted to kind of get a couple of key points of your pretty long journey with, you know, I would say you're seasoned in your position. What are one or two key points of big challenges you face and how you overcame them?
Yeah, the big challenges, I tell people all the time when they say, how's politics? I said, the people part of politics is great.
Yeah.
It's meeting the Pavels of the state and the folks who are aspiring across the state. My wife and I have made a lot of really good friends and seen some incredible things across the state. The politics of the business is what's horrible, you know. And, you know, we have politics in anything. You have politics in the work environment every once in a while, and certainly politics local. But, you know, the politics of the piece is probably the hardest part to navigate. And that's because a lot of things that career politicians or politics want to do doesn't make sense. Sometimes the truth is not always exactly clear in some things people say. And so that gets very aggravating to answer your question.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to tell people who I am and what I'm about and how I can help you. And, you know, just try to figure out an answer to a solution. I don't want to have to go through all these gyrations of all these other little games that a lot of people like to play. And so the biggest barrier I've had so far is really just trying to get politics put aside and just make common sense decisions and try to help people out. And it's worked to a certain degree. It takes longer in some situations than others, but that's probably the biggest barrier.
Yeah. What would you say your approach is to overcoming the politics of politics? No pun intended there. Because I once spoke to a city administrator here in Missouri, and he restructured an entire city, and the cities around it were positively impacted. But he took a very kind of, I would say, vigorous approach where he came in and he said he replaced 70% of the people. And I don't see you doing that, which I think is a good thing. I think each one is up to their own interpretation. But what is your approach through your lieutenant governor position to navigating through those challenging political situations?
Well, sure. I'm a relationship person. And we talked about it earlier where, you know, you build a relationship with a guy whose car you wash or whose client that you build a vehicle for. And the same thing in the political world is you build relationships with people and you start to know them on a personal level. It's a lot tougher for them to be kind of politically mischievous behind the scenes as they know you as a person. They know you as a father, as a husband, as a business person. And so I like to try to dig and build that relationship, not when I need those people, but before I need them.
Oh, okay.
So when I get to the point where I need to ask them, can you help my friend with a permitting problem down in Springfield, Missouri, I already know that person. It wasn't the first time I talked to him on the phone. And that's the best way to handle life, in my opinion. But certainly it works very well in the political spectrum. And it doesn't always work. There's some people who, we're just opposite. We're not, you know, going to get along. It doesn't mean I hate that person.
Yeah.
It just means that I know that they might not be the best avenue to get something done. So you figure out who the people are, who you can work with, who you can't, and then you move the ball down the field like that.
I like that. So relationship-based, that's, I think, key today. I once was asked, you know, how do you sell a $1.2 million truck? And I didn't know how to answer the question. And so I called one of my first clients and I'm like, hey, how are you doing? This and that. And I'm like, can I just ask you like a question? I need you to answer it to me personally. I'm younger and you from halfway across the country purchased a $1.25 million truck for me. Why did you select me, not one of my other few competitors just in the United States alone? And the line kind of went quiet for a moment. And then he's like, Paul, I didn't buy your truck. I bought you. And that really resonated with me that it is indeed relationship-based.
Yeah. I'm familiar with a few of your customers and your product, and I think that's probably a very accurate statement. That's where you struggle when you grow. You've got to get more Pavels out there that people want to fill to build a relationship. But you'll do it. You'll understand.
Well, how did you do it? You highlighted that you had key and loyal people in your business journey, now in your political path. How do you find those loyal people?
Well, you know, I always found that when you deal with, and, you know, by the way, sometimes this works in the political world too, but in the business world, you find people who are willing to step up. The talent's there. Yeah. You just got to have to give them an opportunity. But you also have to understand some people want to be in a certain position and don't have a desire to move up. Yeah. And every once in a while, especially in a business, somebody goes through the production facility and they become maybe the line manager. And then you assume they want to become the production manager. They might not want to do that. They might feel comfortable in the spot they're at. So find people, get them to the spot where they're most comfortable and let them stay there. And then also find the people who say, hey, I want to keep going, and give them an opportunity. Businesses sometimes mess up because they assume because somebody's got to here, that person automatically wants to go to here. Yep. That's not always the case. So recognize their talents and then recognize the people who have the heart to say, boss, I want to do more. I can do more. I can do better. Give me the chance. I want to give them the chance.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to get into kind of the campaigning side.
Oh, boy.
So just on my LinkedIn last year, we had north of 14 million engagement just on LinkedIn, not counting all my other platforms. This year, we're on track to do over 100 million engagement on my LinkedIn only, not counting Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. And I noticed within that, when we recently did like a poll on demographics, we have a lot of not only C-level individuals that are very intrigued on the behind the scenes, but I'm also connected with fellow lieutenant governors across the country, fellow governors and fellow politicians that are always wanting to know how to successfully campaign. How do I become lieutenant governor? How do I become governor? And so I would like to start with first kind of rewinding to your campaigning for lieutenant governor. What would you say was the key for that office when you were campaigning?
Well, it was interesting because the lieutenant governor's position can kind of be what you want it to be. I mean, you can, you know, it doesn't, and by constitution, it doesn't have to be your only job. You can have another job and be lieutenant governor versus other statewide offices, not so much. But Governor Parson was lieutenant governor before I was, and he worked very hard across the state. He established a Buy Missouri program. He really stepped up our game in Missouri for our advocacy for veterans, who was a huge important item to me, our taking care of our heroes across the state. And so, you know, I had a little bit of a model to look at what Mike and Teresa had done as they campaigned for lieutenant governor and then effectively were lieutenant governor. So following kind of where Parson had gotten that office role to be was important to me. But the other thing was, and we've talked about it a lot, is I'm a people person. I like to go out and meet people. I want to see their business. I want to see their family farm. I want to visit with them in the coffee shop. I want to find out what they're about. And I like to think I can connect with people, and I really enjoy talking to people. And the last piece that was really good in our lieutenant governor campaign is my oldest daughter, who had been living in Charlotte, North Carolina, and really was one of my daughters that said, I'm moving and I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, guess what? She missed mom and dad. She missed Missouri. She won't tell you this, but she really did.
Yeah.
And I convinced her to take a year off in the banking business she was in and run my lieutenant governor's campaign. And her and I traveled together because Claudia, we still had some younger kids that were home. Yeah. Claudia could travel, but not as much as she can now. And so my daughter and I went everywhere. Wow. And we had the best time together. And that's I'll never, ever forget that. I'll never get that chance again.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Yeah. So now we jump into lieutenant governor to governor. It's amazing to me because in some retrospects, our social circles overlap. And anyone I seem to talk or your name comes up and they're like, oh, yeah, he's going to be governor. Oh, his like just your initiatives, your beliefs. And for me, it's like, wow, it's like I one time was writing you an email and I almost addressed you as Governor Mike Kehoe. What do you think is that key to your success in your campaign right now?
Well, A, it's very humbling. You know, you've heard a little bit about my story. It's incredibly humbling for people to to, you know, kind of assume and say that, you know, you're going to be the guy and you're going to make it, because I've always been the underdog. Mm-hmm. And I like running from behind and making sure that I'm working as hard as I can to get to the position I want to go to. Running for governor is intense. You better be ready to work 6 days a week and sometimes seven, and you better be willing to work 12, 14, 15 hours a day. You and I know how to do that.
Yeah.
Not everybody does. And other people will run for governor that, you know, have a good work ethic. But I think our work ethic is really, really important. And we're going to be where we need to be and see the people that we need to see so that folks can understand who I am.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people I had a job for this one. If it doesn't work out, I understand business. I've got plenty of opportunities to do. So this isn't something I feel is my destiny, and I think that that's what also helps me connect with people. This is just something I want to do to give back. Yeah. And certainly it's a horribly financial decision for your family. It's not lucrative being in politics based on small business,
yeah.
Although I had some bad small business years. So it's really something you want to have to do from your heart, and you want to be able to make sure people understand you're doing this not for me. I'm done. I mean, yeah. My book is written. I'm doing it for you and your kids and my kids and our grandkids someday. I want generations of Missourians to succeed and want to live here in Missouri, and I mean that from my heart. And I think when I talk to people, they understand that. And that's our message. We want Missouri to be a better place. We can get to a great direction, and our future is incredibly bright.
That's powerful. I unfortunately can never be president. I immigrated here at about 3 years old, but I remember early on in my life, I always envisioned if I were to become president, what the first thing would be that I would do. And I kept telling myself I would probably be go and look into the archives of all those secret kind of conspiracy theories. And so what do you kind of envision?
Let's see if there's a secret tunnel between one building and the other,
yes,
or something
yes.
like that. Yeah.
What do you, as you know, first thing as governor, what's your kind of desire and ambition? And I want this to be a twofold question. First, I kind of want to know that you and I, you know, what is that maybe early on in business, like what's that one funny thing you would do? And then of course, we'll transition that into professionally, politically, what you envision some of the first steps doing as governor of Missouri.
Well, the funny thing that people tease me about is they want to get on the roof of the governor's mansion for some reason. I don't know what the I don't know what the desire is all about it. They're like, can we get on the roof of that building? I'm like, really? So that's not my main goal in life. It's just funny when people say that to me. I'm
yeah.
like, what brought that to you?
I wonder what's up there.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe that's it. They're curious. Seriously, the first thing I really want to do is one of the biggest issues, if not the biggest issue, as we travel the state on a very serious level, is community safety, crime.
Yeah.
And I find that in all areas of the state. And people really want their communities to be safe. It can be an urban neighborhood. It can be a rural neighborhood. It doesn't matter the size of the community. Missourians very much respect the men and women who serve as law enforcement officers.
Right.
They respect how they work very hard and give of their lives, literally, to make our communities the places they are. And so our very first act when we're governor is to make sure people know we are the friendliest state in the union towards our law enforcement officers, and we are going to give them the resources they need to do their jobs, protect our communities, and keep this state the great state that it is. That is a very, very important thing to me. I was raised by a police community in the neighborhood that we grew up in. A lot of our, basically, if you're an Irish immigrant, your family was a policeman or a fireman.
Exactly.
And so the law enforcement community and what they do for our state and the sacrifices they make is important to me. And I want to make sure we have their back. And we use that as a foundation for communities to prosper and grow, for businesses to prosper and grow, for our economy to prosper and grow. I think community safety is the thing that we want to focus on the very first day.
That's awesome. I'm sure you get it all the time, but people ask me quite frequently, especially at dinner gatherings or like social events, oh, you know Kehoe or you know Parsons, what are their thoughts on this or what are they planning on doing on that? I want to go through a list of hot topics, and if you don't feel comfortable answering any one of them, you don't have to.
Well, you have me on film. What do you think I'm going to do, just walk away or jump out the window or something?
You could say next.
I'm good.
So let's start with what's most hot right now, Texas.
Yeah.
The border there. Talk to me about that. What is going on? What are we doing about it? What are you going to do about it?
Well, it is a very hot issue, and it tends to be next to crime, and sometimes with the hand in glove kind of situation, it's kind of talked about in the same breath when somebody's talking about it. I'm going to do a lot about it, and let me tell you what we've already done about it. Last October, when the governor was out, I had the actually the honor to be able to deploy 1251st. It's our National Guard unit out of Harrisonville, Nevada, Missouri, who are on the border now. It's our second unit that we send down there to support Governor Abbott down on what's happening in the border. And here's why border security is so important. And your listeners of this podcast need to know something. And this is, I'm not trying to be partisan. I'm trying to be very, very factual. Making our border secure has got to be the number one thing we do at this country. Yeah. And we need the right leadership in Washington, D.C. to take that very seriously. Yeah. You came here legally. My family came here legally. We can still be the country of the land of opportunity. I wouldn't be sitting here without it. You wouldn't be sitting here without it. But we want the right process to be followed. And certainly our country can't take millions of people that are coming across the border and try to figure out how to pay for them, take care of them. I mentioned veterans earlier. I have a real problem when we're having illegal people come into this country and into the state of Missouri, and our resources are fixed, right? Just like in business, just like people's household, our resources are fixed. You don't have enough resources to deal with all this and take care of the core people, which are your seniors, your veterans, et cetera. So it's very important to make sure on a national level, we push for policies and people that are willing to keep our border secure. Yeah. And on a statewide level, every state is a border state. You don't have to be Texas to be a border state.
Right.
We have more people coming into our state that are coming here illegally, and they're bringing some bad things with them. Fentanyl is the number one killer of Missourians between the ages of 18 and 42.
Wow.
And if we have people on our streets selling fentanyl that are killing our residents, when I'm governor, those people are going to be charged with murder. Yeah. Murder one. You cannot come to Missouri and sell fentanyl and kill my kids and my residents without being sent to jail for life. That has to stop. That drug that's coming across this country and into Missouri specifically is unbelievably horrible of what it's doing to our residents, and we need to crack down on that. We also have nobody wants to talk about it, but the border has resulted in a lot more human trafficking and sex trafficking.
Yeah.
And so that is a deterioration for our young people across our state, and we need to make sure that we secure the border and the people that are coming here to take care of our youth around our communities, because that's not a large or small community thing. Yeah. That's happening everywhere. So border security is a number one.
That's so extraordinary that you see it that way, that it directly impacts us. I think the kind of false impression that people often get is, oh, that's kind of Texas problem. Let's focus on something else. But yes, you're most definitely correct. It does impact us directly. I recently had dinner with one of my professors from college. He reached out to me on one of my social media platforms. He's like, hey, I want to get together and I want to take you out to dinner. And you wouldn't believe it. One of the first questions he asked me, he's like, Pablo, what's going on in China? What is your inner circle saying? And I'm like, well, first of all, I don't think I have an inner circle. I just have friends and family. And he has this very intriguing theory about China dominating the world. And I'm sure you've seen some of the recent press from there. What are your thoughts and views on China? And then kind of building off of that, what do you foresee yourself as governor doing?
Well, listen, they're our adversary. And, you know, we have, this country has some great, great allies and great allies who are investors in the state of Missouri that we want to appreciate and help prosper and grow. But our adversaries are a problem. Yeah. And whether it's China or Russia or Venezuela, et cetera, they're a problem. And when people talk to me about China, they're like, do you think that China's going to be sending troops and tanks over here? I said, no. When China takes over something, it's not going to be through what you think is a traditional warfare. It's going to be through economy. It's going to be through social media. It's going to be through methods that they can control the outcome, maybe without ever firing a shot. And so us being able to become incredibly independent, we saw and learned a lot in COVID about how to we need to repatriate our jobs. Remember all the crises and the shipping crisis and all the supply chain issues we had? You know, getting things built over here again, making sure we're manufacturing, encouraging Missouri and USA businesses to grow and prosper. Yeah. That's our best defense against an economic attack.
Yeah, that's really well said. You mentioned the next one, Russia and Ukraine. So much going on. What are your views? Is Russia going to nuke the United States?
Well, I mean, I believe that most practical people who really understand the threat that Russia is to us understand that stopping them in Ukraine, and certainly you have been on the forefront of what's happening there more than anybody, is paramount to their potential expansion into other territories or areas that they feel rightfully somehow should be under their control as well. Yeah. And expanding their footprint is not good for global security.
Yeah, I agree. The next one for us is going to be, we kind of touch bases on different countries. I want to bring it here back to the country. There's a lot of, I call them conspiracy theories. I don't know what you call them, but different things like, oh, corporate America taking over, or, you know, all these different divisions among states, or I think recently the most radical one I heard that Texas is going to become its own country. What is your view on the unity? You get to meet, you know, presidents, you get to meet governors, you get to meet these people. From your experience, what is your view on the United States and corporate America?
Well, you know, my mother was very Christian, and she raised me to understand how important the Bible is. First thing I would tell people is Facebook is not the Bible.
I like
that. There is one Bible, and it's not social media. Yeah. And a lot of these conspiracy theories, as you know, can grow very quickly now in the social media world.
Exactly.
And it's amazing to me how many people just assume it's automatically true. And I'm like, check the facts out. You can do research. Google can be good and bad, and the good way to use it is to look into whether Texas is going to secede from the Union. I think there's always reasons to be concerned with different things that are happening. You don't want to just blow certain stuff off.
Yeah.
But certainly there's a lot more out there in the kind of conspiracy theory world, or I call the black helicopter world, than I think is actually going on. I deal with a lot of corporations. I was on Ford's dealer council. I was one of 42 dealers to deal with Ford Motor Company, with the chairman of Ford, with the president of Ford, at a very young age. And I've seen the corporate culture from the highest levels at a brand that's iconic, that's been around since 1903. And I've interacted with a lot of those people, to your point. And certainly there can be areas of concern with corporate greed and governance. But for the most part, those corporations also need market share, customers, and people to buy their product,
exactly.
Right? And so at the end of the day, they have to balance that.
Yeah, I like that. I promise I'll only ask one more trick question.
You can ask me all you want.
Interest rates and the economy. You and I know, you know, direct impact, and we'll get into that detail later on. But what is your view on what's going on right now? Is it recession, interest rates? Kind of what's your outlook and perspective on things?
Well, inflation is killing us. And the average person that I talk to every day up and down the street, that's what they're concerned with. What is the price of milk that they're buying? What about the 2x4 they need to buy to, you know, fix up the handrail on their house? Inflation has just been out of control. We've went from a energy exporter to an energy importer. We need, again, to be able to control what we're doing here in our country, to be able to provide not only the jobs, but the independence in the energy sector and other sectors that we need to do. Certainly, we enjoyed a long period of very low, if not zero, interest rates,
right.
Practically zero.
Yeah.
And I think you saw the economy grow much better.
Yeah.
Here's what I think is the good news. If we get inflation under control, and again, I think that's a leadership issue in Washington, D.C., and I believe the current administration is not able to get their hands on it as well as maybe a potential new administration could. But wage growth has been significant the last 3 or 4 years. You've seen it personally. I've seen it personally. And as you know, if we can get inflation and interest rates under control, I think the market's going to be very good. So I'm optimistic. Why? Because people that were making $16 an hour 5 years ago are making $22 an hour now. People who are making 30 are making 37, et cetera. The whole wage bracket has grown. Now, it's been tough on business. It's one of the reasons inflation is where it is. But if you can get interest rates low and get inflation to stop rising, you'll still have solid wages out there. Mm. And you'll have capital in the market to put liquidity and cash into business, into retail sector. So I believe there's a way forward. But I think at the national level, and certainly states, we, you know, states' rights are the most important thing to me. That's what the 10th Amendment is all about. Certainly, we need to make sure that we protect our economy. We can't put, we talked about a border wall earlier between, you know, Texas and Mexico. Right. We don't have a border wall between Missouri and D.C. Mm. So we need to make sure we have the right delegation and our congressional delegation, our senatorial delegation. And I think the country really needs to think long and hard about who the leader of the free world is as we move forward.
I like that. I wanted to circle that together. So I frequently in communications and talking to local contractors, local small business owners, even business owners across the strait and across the state in the Midwest. Some of them do 100 million revenue. One particular CEO, his company does $1 billion in revenue a year. And I feel like
that's where you're going to be soon.
Yes, exactly. And so
congratulations.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it. We have a really good strategic plan and a strong team supporting us.
I'm a capitalist, so I'm happy for you.
Oh, thank you.
I love success.
Thank you.
I love success.
We've gotten a strong strategic team that's put out a 10-year plan for us, and we're year four and on track, and then some retrospect ahead of our strategic plan. So thank you. And so they asked me a similar question that I once, Jack Stack was sharing with me back in the 80s when there was a really bad recession. His employees and friends were asking him, well, do we get married? Do we buy a house? Do we buy a car? Like serious financial decisions. And so I have similar questions being asked to me right now by these business owners and CEOs. Paul, do we build that factory? Do we expand our business? Just because of these simple topics we were talking about, Texas, China, Russia. I want to ask you that question. I don't think there's a better person I can ask today. Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe, do we build another factory?
Well, I'm humble that you would think I'm the best person. And when you've had Jack Stack, et cetera, who's an inspiring, incredibly successful business person that we're both pleased to know.
Remind me to give you his answer after you give your answer.
Okay. My answer is this. You need to make sure what you have is, if you're going to build a factory or expand your business, what is the product you're selling and what is the market about? Imagine how the guy, you know, 20 years ago felt, and you don't even know what this is, who manufactured cassette tapes. You know what a cassette tape is?
I saw a picture once, I think.
Yeah, right. But I bet that's right. But they were wildly popular, right?
Like
they
everyone were, was using
them. Cases of them. You had carrying bags that carried them around. And so if I was the carrying bag manufacturer or the cassette tape manufacturer, I might answer that question a little differently than if I was something that had to deal with IT, something that was on the horizon about to take off versus something that I'm not sure what the future is about. Yeah. Cassette tape manufacturers ultimately went bye-bye. The companies that made those, by the way, they survived because they figured out what the next cassette tape was going to be, and they repositioned themselves. I think investing in our country and our economy has never been a better time. Interest rates might be a little bit high, and that will have to level itself out, and the businesses will have to make a decision on cash flow. But I think we're at a really exciting time, mainly because we just talked about earlier, I think there's a lot of liquidity in the market with the wage growth that we've seen. Yeah. And I think there's a very strong feeling of patriotism to produce, and not only produce, but to purchase products made in the state of Missouri. You've seen that through our Buy Missouri program, and in the United States. And so making sure that the product you make or going to sell has a life expectancy to it is number one. But assuming you feel good about that, I think the economy is in a position to really take off.
Jack said the same thing, except he highlighted that a key component is having someone like yourself in office pushing free market. And so we are investing in the economy. We are about to move into a factory. We're already designing a gigafactory for it. Just today, we launched another division within our holding companies. And so I agree, because if you look at the history, I mean, there was a time we had 18% interest rates.
Right.
I remember when I got my rate on my first business loan, I think it was like 11%. And I called one of my younger friends / advisors, my age business owner. He's like, oh, Paul, that's astronomical. But then I'm like, I need to ask someone older for their opinion. And I called one of my other mentors, and he was probably at that time, maybe 63, 65. So not old, just older. And he laughs on the line. He's like, Pavel, you're lucky. My first business loan was 18.5%. And so I think I agree 100%. This is the time to invest in our
I don't want to take up your whole podcast, but when I went from washing cars to selling cars, I'll never forget as long as I live, running out and greeting a customer on the lot. He wanted to buy a cargo van. He was a plumber, like what you put windows in, but no windows in it. And he said, what's the interest rate? And I'm 20 years old. And I don't know, I didn't even know what interest rate was, to tell you the truth. And I said, let me find out. So I ran in and talked to one of my managers, and he said, it's 18%. And I said, okay. And I ran back out, and I said, it's 18%. And the guy almost came unglued on me. And I'm like, and I wasn't being smart like what he thought I was. I said, that's good, isn't it? And he's like, no, that's not good. You know, he's a small business guy just trying to get by. I not only sold the van, he became my best customer.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because I told him, I said, I'm so sorry, sir. I'm new, and I'm trying to learn this business, and I, quite frankly, didn't even know it. I learned quickly why interest rate was important. Very first customer I ever met.
That's amazing. You highlighted kind of the country spirit is strong, and it's time to, you know, invest in our economy. I want to bring it into Missouri. And so thank you, first of all, for traveling Missouri. I didn't know half the stuff I know about Missouri until I followed you on LinkedIn. I now feel like I know every association, every high school. I mean, it seems like 2-3 trips a day. You kind of covered what that takes, 6 days a week. What is your, you are hands-on, like you're in the forefront. What is your kind of vibe or impression of the spirit within the hearts of Missourians?
Well, I think, you know, you hit on it earlier, what Jack Stack said, is that we have a very optimistic citizenry here. A lot depends on who the leaders are, whether it's that in their community, maybe their school board or their county commission or their state elected officials. But Missouri is very resilient. You know, we're an agrarian state. Agriculture is our number one industry. 95,000 family farms is number two in the United States. $93 billion impact on our state's economy and agriculture. And as you know, people who are in agriculture are very hard workers.
Oh, yeah.
Many multiple generation farmers out there. My wife and I are first generation.
Wow.
So it's a very different spectrum in that regard. But because of that, I believe that Missouri really is a very optimistic place. You meet the people, the naysayers, and things are horrible and everything.
Right.
But for the most part, the people that we interact with, that we run or cross, the business owners, the family farmers, or just the person in the coffee shop, once they get through kind of complaining about the issue of the day, then they become very positive.
Yeah, very well said. Kind of off topic on another side, kind of side note, people often ask my parents, Pavel, how did your parents raise you? And my dad oftentimes jokes, he's like, guys, I had 11 children and only one came out obedient, and it wasn't Pavel. And so I kind of want to ask
you. I thought he was going to say I have 11 children. I can't remember their names.
Birthdays for him. Yeah. He's got the names down pretty well. For him, it's birthdays.
Yeah, whenever I sit down with somebody, they say, how old are your kids? I said, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz. So,
so let's kind of dive into the family side of you. I want to get kind of behind the scenes, those things that people may not know about you. You highlighted how your mother raised you. What about you? What did you and Claudia do that really set your children up for the success that they have today?
Well, we think we taught them, you know, how to work hard. I really still believe that's the foundation to success, life, happiness, family, et cetera, is how to work hard. So I hope and I think we've installed a good work ethic into them. We've also made sure that they understand what respect is. Our country and some of our young people have really lost the ability to show respect. And that doesn't just necessarily mean to their elders. John Wayne once said, if you don't respect your elders, you better respect your betters. And so we raised them in a Christian household. At some point in time, kids, you'll find this out someday, the religion has to become theirs. And so you can only push them so far. And then they got to decide whether they're going to accept Jesus as our Lord and Savior. We hope they do, and we think that they will. We're very proud of our kids. We have three girls and one boy, and they've all presented challenges at different times in their life. My oldest daughter just got married 2 months ago, so our first child to get married. We have no grandkids. And so we have a son-in-law now. That's a new experience. My son is very happy because he's always been around his three sisters and his mother. He was kind of surrounded because I was probably worked too much. I was always at work. Now he's got kind of a brother in his new brother-in-law.
That's
so
awesome.
That's kind of exciting to see. Yeah. But we're really proud. They're like I say, they're working hard. The ones that aren't married seem to be hanging around some really good people right now. So it's kind of neat to watch all that. It's neat to watch them go into adulthood and start paying bills.
That's
and
awesome.
Calling me and saying, "Dad, did you know how much his car insurance is?" Yeah, I paid for it for 8 years.
Yeah,
now it's your turn.
That's awesome. So. You highlighted religion and faith and the role it plays in your life, and similar to it plays a large role in my life. I remember early on in my business journey, I didn't have that kind of that boldness to share my personal beliefs and views until I had a client from California fly in. And they asked me, they observed in my character and my the way that I walk, the way that I dress. And they asked me, and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to share with them. They already made the sale. They already made the wire transfer. I have nothing to lose. And so I shared with them my views, my beliefs.
They can take those wire transfers back, so be careful.
Okay. And so I shared with them what I believe. And I will never forget the gentleman. He had tears coming down his eyes. Like, "Wow, Pavel, you really inspired me." And that early on for me has been kind of a building block to always stand for what I believe. What is that pillar in your life that helps you stand up for what you believe in the situations where it seems like everyone in the room is against what you believe?
Well, first of all, the good Lord put you in his life or that man's life for a reason.
Amen.
And I tell people that, you know, Christianity, we have a big tent. You know, you might not believe exactly what we believe. We might think we're going to get to heaven, point A to point B, a little bit different, but you know, we have a big tent, and it's cool to be around faith believers. It's just who we are. It's who my mother raised us to be. My mom, we're Catholic. My mom was a daily communicant. She went to 6 a.m. Mass every morning. We live close enough she could walk to church because we had one car between five people, you know, and most times that was broke down.
Yeah.
So my mom was a very strong person of faith. My number two child in her family, my older sister Carol, died of leukemia. Mm. And my mom had to, you know, handle that, handle her husband leaving her, handle raising these kids, making ends meet. And she, if she were alive today, she would tell you that she would have never made it through that without faith.
Wow.
And when you grow up seeing that, it, I don't want to say it comes automatically, but it makes you appreciate how important that is.
That's so inspiring. Thank you for sharing that. It means a lot to us. And continuing on that leg of faith, there's also political views. As you know, today, mainstream media makes it very divided or very divisive amongst Democratic and Republican. But how do you stand kind of where you, I mean, you'd have to, you have to. Me, I feel like as a business owner, I can be kind of more skewed to one side, but you have to not only keep the state together, but keep states together amongst other states as one union. How do you accomplish that?
Well, first of all, what you see in the media, I think, whether it's on social media or mainstream media, they like to portray the views of maybe the extreme right and the extreme left.
Right.
And I think the country in Missouri is more together than what they sometimes portray. That doesn't mean you don't let go of your core values. I'm a conservative Christian family man. That's my core of faith, and I'll never leave those values. But that doesn't mean I can't talk to somebody who is an agnostic or thinks differently than I do. Because at the end of the day, everybody, in my mind, most people want to see us move forward, not backwards.
Yeah.
And so it's, again, that relationship piece. I can't tell you how important that is. I think you find common ground with these people. You find a common way to move forward. You can't find a common way to exist. That's who we as a country are. That's how our country was built. I mean, you know, the original original founding fathers, when they went to sign the Declaration of Independence, didn't compromise a little bit, we'd still be in that hall in Philadelphia today.
Exactly.
You know, they figured they had very strong values. They want to give up their values, but they knew to move the country forward, they were going to have some give and take.
Yeah.
And that's how our country was built. And today, all of a sudden, it's like you're not conservative if you're willing to compromise. Well, that's not right.
Yeah.
You can hold your core conservative values. And if you're in my position, when I consider myself a salesman, I'm going to make sure I compromise to when the deal's done. It does lean my way, right? And so some way or another, we're going to make that happen.
I like that. I feel like that's what younger politicians lack. I had a chance, a couple individuals came asking for my endorsement, and they're, you know, they're early 30s, and it just, It reminds me of me when I started business. You know, I feel like everybody owed me something. I was so like, you know, dominant, and it just, I look at them and I'm like, how do you get past that? Because you seem so well seasoned. You almost remind me of my dad in a sense, to where it's like, guys, we got to stay united regardless of our views. How do we help this younger generation not be so divided amongst themselves?
Well, first of all, I would say, this has become a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
It's awful easy to say something from a keyboard or a phone versus me looking you in the eye.
Exactly.
And so that's a new tool that wasn't out there when I was growing up. And so I tell my kids all the time, a handshake is way more important than, you know, sending a text.
Yeah.
Looking somebody in the eye is way more important. A handshake should mean more than a signature. I mean, those are the types of fundamental things that the young folks, because they've grown up with some incredible technology that can be very powerful, that's helped all of us advance in life, that personal relationship has to be something they develop before you judge a person's character.
Yeah.
They want to judge somebody's character based on what they just read on whatever.
Yeah.
And they don't even know the person.
Yeah.
So that interaction, that personal skill, we've got to make sure we do what we can. And I don't know if that's, I think it's more at the family level than it is the educational level, to make sure that people understand those are qualities. Your dad taught you the right thing. My mom taught us the same thing. If we're going to survive, we're going to have to stick together. We really had no choice.
Yeah.
And so we always helped each other out. If I was mowing lawns when I was a kid and got behind, my sister and my brother would come help me. My mom got behind doing what she did. We came and helped her. And so, you know, you just work together and figure it out.
Yeah. Do you think that whether it's political, religious, or even business, the younger generation that has like such radical views, such like, hey, divide or you know, destroy, like this one you know, industry leader here said, I replace 70%, you know, just like a very, almost like too much of an alpha kind of characteristic. Do you think those individuals, that life will mold them to become more like wise and acceptant and united, or do you think that's a big point of concern for us as a state and us as a country?
It's a concern. I think most people end up eventually getting it because they find out my way or the highway doesn't work very well.
Yes, that's the quote I was looking for, yeah.
And it just doesn't. You know, I've never looked somebody and pointed at them, so go do this. I'd say, Pavel, do me a favor. Go see if you can move that car over here so the customer can see it.
Yeah. You know? I like that.
And so people at different stages of life end up figuring out the finger pointing, the I'm going to decide who you are because I read about you on some media platform before I ever met you is probably not the best way to make it through life.
Yeah, I agree. We talked about what it takes to be lieutenant governor, what it takes to walk in your shoes, what it takes to be even a day in your life and even, you know, a decade in your life. I want to, in conclusion, kind of transition to quite literally suits and shoes. So I grew up really poor and I always thought successful people, whether it be a governor or a president, they wear something, you know, like Louis Vuitton or some designer brand. And I quickly learned.
I don't even know who that is.
I quickly learned that
What does Walmart sell? That's what I want you to tell me. That's what I'm going to wear.
That's awesome. So yeah, that answers my question in part. I learned very quickly as I started meeting and becoming close friends with these successful leaders. They wear like simple clothing, simple non-branded stuff. What is your go-to outfit, whether you're in the Capitol or whether you're out on the farm? Is it different? Is it the same? Talk a little bit about your clothing choice.
Well, in the Capitol, I think it's different because I believe that building and the offices in that building deserve respect.
Wow.
And it's coat and tie and pants, and you dress to respect the position and the building and the people who have given literally blood, sweat, and tears to get our country and our state to where it is today. And so I believe that the official offices, when you're in them and occupying them, Senate floor, et cetera, I think they deserve a level of respect. And so the way I dress indicates my respect for that particular place we're going to. Outside of the Capitol, my most comfortable attire is jeans. And my wife, thank goodness, is the same way. We're very comfortable in jeans. At the farm, we're in jeans and some ratty old T-shirt and maybe an old hat or something. I mean, what clothes, you know, to me doesn't make the person.
That's amazing that you highlight that, especially the Walmart comment. I remember the first person that asked me, hey, where'd you get your shoes? And I told them Walmart, and I thought they'd laugh. And they're like, whoa, that's so cool. And they actually went and got a pair of shoes from Walmart. It was like $13. You can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, well, now shoes are the exception. As you get older, you'll understand your feet are a little more finicky, and you got to get – I'm particular on what boot I wear. I wear boots every day, all day long. But
yeah,
I'm
well,
finicky.
Bring us
and,
up to speed.
Hey, Bass Pro, since we're in Springfield, they have jeans and stuff now too, so you get a lot of good clothes there, and Johnny Morris has got that figured out. He's got some great buys on clothes there too.
Yes, I think if of my five brothers, I think 90%+ of their closets is Bass Pro Shops. Mm-hmm. Let's highlight boots. What are your go-to boots? I always see a nice pair, broken-in nice pair.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. Most of my boots are old, but if you take care of them, they'll last a long time.
Awesome.
I think, as you know, my wife and I, besides raising cattle, are also into quarter horses. I showed horses for a long time in an event called Cutting Horses. And you take care of the leather, you take care of the harness, you take care of everything that you use on that horse, and they'll last a lot longer. Same thing with boots.
Yeah,
I'm a Lucchese boot fan. They're made here in the United States still. And I really think that, you know, there's a lot of good boot brands out there, so don't get me wrong. But Lucchese is my go-to boot.
That's awesome. In conclusion, I want to highlight three key takeaways from this interview and all the experiences that you've gone through in your life. And I want to cover a key takeaway from you as a family man. I want to highlight a key takeaway as you as a successful business owner. And then I want to highlight a key takeaway as you as a, I think not only in my opinion, but the state of Missouri, a successful politician in a non-political way. So let's start with family man. What is your kind of words of encouragement or wisdom to our generation today as a family man?
Patience. You really have to have patience to be a good family man. It's trying at times. The relationship between you and your kids, the relationship between you and your wife, and some days the easiest thing seems to be, well, I'm just going to give up. Yeah. But you can't, because a lot of people are relying on you, especially if you're the mother or the father. Equal roles, I would say, is important. You got to have patience, and you got to be willing to keep trying.
Patience and never giving up. I love that. I'm going to add that to my quote book.
Oh boy. So, I don't know if I want to be in your quote book.
Believe me, you do. And so the next thing, successful in business. I think if you were to ask me what you just said about family, I would say about business, patience,
it
and never
work.
Giving up.
Yeah.
What is your key takeaway to a business owner in today's time and age trying to succeed? What is your key word of advice for them?
You have to be optimistic, and you have to be willing to be a risk taker. One of my favorite expressions in business is the world belongs to risk takers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't mean do stupid stuff, but that means you got to be on the edge. You got to be out there, and you got to be willing to go to that next level. You can't be afraid, and you got to be willing to move forward.
Exactly.
And so you got to have a little bit of adversity to risk, and you got to be willing to step up and get to that next level.
Yeah, I love it. And then last but not least, politics. And I want to just take a moment on this one because this one,
your whole posture just changed on this question.
Yes, I have an interesting experience with politics. And so I kind of want to, unrated version. I just want the not so much the lieutenant governor, Mike Kehoe, but just Mike to Paul. What is your kind of key takeaway on politics?
Well, the key takeaway is you move things forward, as we've mentioned throughout this entire podcast, with relationships and who the people are. Who you can trust and who you can rely on, I think, is very important. I think you need to be a pleasant person to be around. I think people need to like you. But you also need to make sure people understand, don't ever confuse kindness for weakness. Mm. You can be kind, but that doesn't necessarily mean weak. You need to be able to have the intestinal fortitude to make decisions and stick with them. You need to follow your gut and say, we're going to go this direction, and let's go. Now, you might get a lot of people to give you input to get to that decision, and you should. You don't want to make decisions in a vacuum. But once you make up your mind, say we're going forward, go forward.
I like that. That's very well said. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe. And thank you for everybody joining us on this episode of Suits and Shoes. Follow our journey. You can follow Mr. Kehoe on his Instagram and get all the behind the scenes of his campaigning and his journey on becoming the next governor of Missouri. Thank you.